Thanks, David. My name's Eric, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Eric.
And an addict. See, no one walked out, thank God. So I've been trying to compose myself. I had no idea what I was getting into, and I agreed to do this a while ago with Gareth, my friend Gary, and I put it right at the back of the, I think beginning of the year we talked about it, and then I thought, well, I know I'll be around a bit more in August, and then when he told me where it was, I couldn't think where this would be, you know. And then when I saw it tonight, I thought, well, that's it, and that looks all right. And then I came in and I saw all these people, and so I didn't get nervous until about 10 seconds, and then it kind of hit me, the enormity of what I got to do. And I think that's born out of the fact that I I'm an addict and an alcoholic, and I have this desperate need to appeal, to get your approval. So I go through all these kind of mental acrobatics for quite a while before I even think about what I'm going to say, and I never know what I'm going to say anyway, about how to make you laugh, how to entertain you, and that's never going to go away. That's part of my psyche, and it'll always be there. And I think it's just a part of my need to be loved. And you know, coming from where I come from, that's always been there, and it'll always be. But it's got better. And I was thinking, well, one of the ways I was composing myself tonight, before I would speak, just to stay calm and try and be sort of centered to talk to you, was by thinking about my kids. I was thinking about my three little girls. I've got these three little girls, and one's two, one's four, and one's six, and they've never seen me scared. And I don't know if that's almost like an artificial thing that I would want to put together for myself to do this, but it's something about, if I just picture them, you know, they make me feel secure, and it's because they love me unconditionally. And I think that's the pureness of that, and that's really what, you know, outside of what I get in these rooms, that's the only place I experience that, you know. And I got that here first time I started to come, and I got it from individuals, from one individual or another, in different ways they would express this thing to me and convey it to me in a way that I had never experienced before. I mean, most of my experience with human relationship up until this had been from people that I was in some kind of negotiating transaction with, you know, different relationships that, you know, I get this if I give you that, you know. And for a long time, my definition of love was, well, what can you give me? You know, what is it? It's about getting. And even in terms of how I was brought up by the elders in my family, it was about acquisition. It was about what I could get for myself. The spiritual awakening I had when I came into this program as a result of working the steps was that my well-being would be enhanced according to how much I gave. And that was when I woke up. So that was my spiritual awakening. And it took a while, even once I got in here, to grasp that. I was still kind of burdened with a way of thinking which had been ingrained upon me for all of my life, from my earliest recollection. And coupled and with and going alongside of that was another kind of set of behavior which had to do with avoidance or anesthetizing myself from the pain of these kind of relationships. And it would start with my early family or with kids at school where I just, you know, I never felt on a par with, because that's part of my disease. I mean, I'm always below or above. I've never been alongside of, you know, anybody. And what I would do from my earliest recollection was I would use substances. I used sugar. My earliest was sugar, you know, was sugar. I mean, when I was a kid, I mean, one of the lads that's sitting on my left who will know what I'm talking about, I would eat boxes or tins of Ovaltine tablets or Horlicks tablets. I mean, I'd just eat the whole lot. And that was, you know, quite a buzz for a 9-year-old, 10-year-old kid. It's a hefty buzz. And even then, it was no moderation involved. You know, it wasn't, you know, I'll save some for later, I'll have two now and then two at lunchtime. It was all in one go, you know, and then chuck the tin in the hedge. And And that's, there was no real acknowledgement of that for me, and it wasn't really acknowledged by the elders in my family. I was raised by my grandparents. There was, it was no message then. Where I lived, there was no message going around about what we have here. You either were a drunk or, there weren't addicts too in the village where I came from. It was drinking. I didn't get hold of drugs until I came to London, and I got into amphetamine and Benzedrine and the things that you could get on the street that would just you buy for the weekend. And then, but so my first experience with changing the way I felt was with sugar or with food, and then, funnily enough, thank God, with music. And music started to work quite powerfully for me at a very early age. And we listened to the radio at lunchtime on Sundays. Two-way family favorites would play amazing music, and it changed my life. And I would listen to opera. I would hear rock and roll, blues, jazz, swing music, and I loved it all. It got me, and it was akin to using for me. I would hide. I would get my healing from it. I would take it as if it was mine, and wrap myself up in it. And no one could get me when I was listening to my music or when I was identifying. And I had all kinds of crazy, surreal worlds that would come alive with that, And I pictured the people that were making the music, and I wanted to be like them. And of course, a little while down the road, I found out that a lot of them could have been in here, That a lot of them were gonna be using people, drinking people, addicts and alcoholics. And when I got that information, that intrigued me. And it also seemed to tie in with a lot of what I was seeing firsthand as a kid, which was, the British Legion. I'm 62 years old, so, I was just after I was born at the end, on the day that they declared peace, in fact. And so my earliest recollections were of a kind of a massive national euphoria going on. When people were just getting smashed all over the place, and all kinds of stuff was happening. And I was born out of wedlock. My dad was a Canadian airman, and my mum was 15 years old, and it was just madness, And what I would see in terms of our community activities was drinking, and it was drinking, but in a different kind of thing. It was like drinking as a celebration. Everyone was having a great time. And music was part of that. But the two things were sort of coupled for me. And as soon as I could, as soon as it was actually manageable, I started lying about my age. I started shoplifting. I started vandalizing. I started doing all the stuff, that was just on the edge, that anything that looked like it was kind of risque. And I never really got busted for anything, I got away with it. I mean, it's always sort of a good runner, a good liar. And lying was an amazing part. I mean, this disease got me before any of its agents, funnily enough, or it was already there, let's say. Maybe that's the way it was. It was dormant, and it didn't really wake up and start to act in any kind of seriously dangerous way until I started putting those agents in me. And it wasn't until I'd been in the program for a little while that I realized this, that in fact, when they talk about restoring to sanity in the second step, that, I had actually been sane at one time, but I had always had the ism. I'd always had this disease. So, if it kind of convinced me, because I'm an alcoholic sitting here talking to a lot of people who may never have had a problem with drinking at all, but we all have the same thing. And it isn't about the agent. It's about what I do with that agent and why. And for me, it was because I wanted love, and I was terrified of the people that would give it to me. I had no idea how to get on with other people. I had no idea how to belong. I had no idea where I was going or who I was. And I was frightened. And when I took these things, they made me feel different. When I took Benzedrine, or when I smoked joints, and when I later took smack, and when I finally and ultimately became an alcoholic, those things were sort of sorted for a while. Really, what was happening was I was anesthetizing the madness, and the madness was there before. And once the drinking and the drugging stopped, it was revealed again. So really what I came to find out in these rooms that was that I needed your help to live, really. I mean, I didn't really need a great deal of help to stop drinking. I mean, that was really sort of academic, you know. But once it was taken away, and once I put it down, a whole lot of things were revealed, and they had been there all the time. And I had started drinking, I mean, not counting the sugar and the other things that I was doing before that. I started drinking when I was 14, and I stopped when I was 42. And so when I came into these rooms, I was 42 going on 14. Really, that's the deal. I mean, what happened was I postponed everything that most normal people do during their adolescence, in terms of growing up, in terms of changing or modifying their behavior, or establishing principles or ideals in order to find their way in relationships or in their work or in the world. Those things I put on hold. I mean, when I picked up drink for the first time, I just thought, I'd like to stay here. You know, I don't see any other point in doing anything but this for the rest of my life. Never mind the fact that, you know, I passed out. I mean, I remember going to the Bewley Jazz Festival when I was 14, starting drinking with a kid that I'd never met before in my life in a pub, having the best time of my life and being unconscious by 7 o'clock in the evening, and then waking up the following morning about 10, having shit myself, pissed myself, vomited all over myself, and I was all alone in the woods. And I had no idea where I was, where all my friends were. And it was the weirdest thing, because coupled with this deep sense of shame about the condition I was in, I was actually exhilarated beyond belief and couldn't wait to do it again, you know. If I'd known what I know now, but I mean, that whole experience was very painful for me, because I saw that, you know, it was a very kind of that I was alone, really. The way already I drank on my first kind of excursion was beyond anything anyone else wanted to put up with. I mean, they abandoned me, and I carried on drinking like that in a fairly experimental way, mixing it up with other stuff. But I would always go beyond where everyone else wanted to go, and I would eventually kind of throw up and carry on. You know, go back in, go outside, throw up, go back in, and carry on. And that's the way I drank, and that's the way I used too. And ideally, for me, the whole thing was only really worthwhile if I was doing it on my own. I really hated using and drinking with other people. I could not stand it. I hated sharing anything. I hated having to ask for anything. And luckily for me, this musical thing kind of took off, and my obsession with that got me into fairly good sort of books, you know, and I did better than all right and I made a lot of money. And I'm sort of jumping here through the period of my life where it wasn't really resolved what I was. I mean, I had no idea who I was anyway, but it wasn't that I was clearly, you know, a down and out or a drunk or an addict or a musician or anything. It just seemed to be, if anything, I was a kind of bum. But I wasn't a bum in a negative way. I was a gentleman of the road, really. I used to sleep on the station down the road here most nights, and I thought that was pretty acceptable. You know, I'd sleep on the bench, and I'd walk around in the morning and go down to the embankment, get a, you know. But it was kind of a pretend life, because I could always go back home and get some money if I was fairly strapped. But all of this was all in flux, really. And the music, you know, my obsession with that got me into a few bands. And by the time I was 21, I was making decent money. And it kept me kind of afloat for a while, but it was all almost as if it was sort of waiting for me to drop my guard. By the time I got to the end of my 20s, it had taken a fairly good grip. And I think, you know, there's a point in most of our lives where we cross a line. I mean, I crossed a line, and I hadn't really been aware of it. You know, I was aware that, you know, most of the relationships I were in were pretty dysfunctional, that people were uncomfortable being around me, that I was not a popular person. My view of life was very selfish. But I really didn't know I'd gone too far until I started dragging people down with me. And I remember a young girl that I'd started dating. Her and I had become involved with this dealer in London, and we started doing smack, not intravenously, just through the nose. And that was really when it started kind of getting heavy. Up until then, I think I could say I was a recreational user, you know, and I would do a lot of blow, and I mix it up with wine, joints. So most of my early 20s were fairly take it or leave it, but the smack got a grip, and I kind of welcomed it. I got to admit that I thought, this finally, you know, what's the point in mucking around with this stuff? Let's get on with it. Although, you know, I never used with a needle because I was terrified of needles, and I had that from getting a nasty kind of diphtheria shot when I was a kid. So I would not, you know, I hate having any kind of injection. So I would, you know, I'd score a few grams of stuff from Gerrard Street, and we used to get this white elephant, and I grind it up with a pestle and mortar, and I'd, within, you know, a couple of days, the whole lot would be gone. It was very wasteful using, but I mean, kind of rock star using, you know. And I got a letter from the father of this girl saying, you know, if you don't, I know what you're up to, and if you don't stop, I'm going to turn you in. And he had a method. There was a woman around at the time who was practicing a thing that she had tried out in Hong Kong. And it was a black box with, you know, sort of things that you put on your ears, which was like an acupuncture, or electronic acupuncture. And believe it or not, you know, I didn't really know what the hell was going on. I just knew that if I didn't go along with this plan of action, that I was going to end up in the nick or something. So, but you know, to be honest with you, there was something left in me that was decent too, that responded to this man's pain and dilemma. And we both went in into clinics. I went and stayed with this family in Harley Street, and they applied this method to me. And to a certain extent, it worked. And it did produce a kind of euphoria, which was a bit like getting high, or it just made me kind of nod, you know. And then the husband of the family was a sort of born again Christian, and he would, you know, chant the Bible at me and all this kind of, I mean, it was very sweet and it was very well meaning. The one thing that was missing really was fellowship, you know, and although, you know, I'm absolutely certain that, you know, the fellowships were going strong at that time. And this was, well, let's think, this is back in the 70s, you know, that actually end at the beginning of the 70s, that this was sort of exempt from their program. And when they kind of, they gave me, after a month living with them, they sort of signed me off with a clean bill of health. I went straight out and got drunk, you know. I mean, that was the answer for me. But they didn't seem to think that was problematic, and nor did I, because from having been, you know, holed up in my house, you know, gobbing at the TV and just sitting in a kind of 6x4 square of narcosis, I was suddenly living a very gregarious life in a pub, you know, back in the pubs, and it felt healthy to me. Apart from the fact, you know, I was drinking exactly the way I did when I was a teenager. So that sort of launched my alcoholic career, really. And I went from, you know, bad to worse pretty quickly. And I took people with me, and I took hostages. And And the deal was, you either drank, you know, my way or the highway, and that was it. You know, if you couldn't keep up, on your bike. So I would also, you know, I'd start in the pub and then I'd go home and I'd take a bottle home. And by this time, you know, a few years down the road, I had got married and I was living with a very beautiful woman, and I had a house. I had spent all the money really that I had made in my career making music on, you know, cars and fine things, and I wanted to die, you know, I mean, and I was exhibiting that, and people, you know, were baffled. I mean, here was a clear kind of example of what a guy could achieve in his life, coming from nothing. You know, I mean, I came from a fairly poor background. You know, when I bought, my grandparents bought my guitar on a hire purchase. You know, it was, and I abused it all. And I never appreciated any of it. And I abused them, I abused anyone that came near me. And I was riddled with guilt about this. And someone bought me a shotgun for Christmas one year, and I would sit with this gun, and I would have, my paraphernalia would be a little Sony tape machine that you could record onto, a guitar, a bottle of vodka, several grams of coke, and this shotgun and a couple of 12-bore cartridges. And a beautiful wife, you know, all of this, I mean, I had all the stuff going on around me. And I'd go up the pub and I'd get drunk and I'd come back and I'd stagger home and I'd, you know, and she'd go off to bed in disgust, and I would finish off all the rest of the stuff I had. And the idea was I was going to write a song, you know. And I couldn't do it. I'd get stuck. And I mean, I'd freeze with all this. Well, I don't know what it was, the chemistry of this, you know, the coke and the vodka. I'd just freeze and I'd get into this paranoia and fear, and I'd put the cartridges in the gun, I'd close the gun, and I'd think about how to do it by, you know, holding the trigger with my thumb and putting the barrels in my mouth. And then I think, well, if I do that, I won't be able to drink. You know, I won't be able to drink tomorrow, or I won't be able to drink. And so, I mean, if that's not insanity, I mean, I think that, you know, that never occurred to me as being insanity until I came in here. It was a kind of frustrating situation for me. You know, I found it, because death or life had kind of reached a point where it didn't really mean anything anymore. It really didn't mean anything. People didn't mean anything. Nothing meant anything. And the thing that kind of really had got me to the grace of despair was the fact that nothing that I had put my faith in was working anymore. I had lost faith in any kind of God. I put all my faith in my substances. And one day I could drink that much, you know, like a thimble full of vodka, and do a couple of lines of blow, and I would pass out. The following day, I could drink three or four bottles of vodka and 10 grams, and nothing would happen. And I had no idea, I had lost control. I mean, because the delight of my life was controlling my drinking, controlling my using. That was the sort of, that was like being, you know, the best surfer in the world or the best snowboarder in the world. I knew how to get to the point of absolute ecstasy and stay there for a little while until I reached the oblivion that I really craved for. Because for me, the essence of it all was to not be here. That was what it was all about, in fact. And so once I found that I could not even control that, I realized I'd crossed that line. And the woman I was living with at the time said to me at one point, let's go, there's some people that want us to go stay for the weekend, let's go up there, and this weekend don't drink and try not to do anything embarrassing, or, you know, try to behave yourself like a grown-up man, you know. And we set off. It was in Rutland, a place in Rutland, sort of a very well-to-do, sort of stately home with some people that we knew. And on the way up there, I got lost, and I went, it was about in the early evening, I went into the phone box in the local village. I asked for directions, I called them up, and as I was talking to them, I felt giddy, I felt kind of slightly faint. And I hadn't had a drink for probably 12 hours. And bearing in mind that I hadn't been sober for maybe 10 years at that point, it hadn't occurred to me that it wasn't a good idea to just suddenly stop. And I started to kind of lose my balance and my equilibrium, and then it came back. It was almost like an inner ear thing that I had going on. But the following day, and that night we found the place. That night, after everyone had gone to bed, I went round the house. Got up and went round looking for him. Everything was locked up, or they'd thrown it all away. It was not a drop in the house. And that, my normal thing would be to go and scavenge anything I could find. And the following day, I felt quite good, actually. I mean, I went out for a long walk with my host, and I felt all right. It was fresh air, and I thought, well, this is not so bad, there was a bit of a tingling going on, my skin felt a little bit raw. But that evening, we went for dinner in this very flash kind of country club. And at some point in the middle of the conversation, before dinner, when everyone was having their sort of Perriers and stuff, I just passed out. And I mean, I just remember the room going sideways, and I came to in an ambulance, and I'd had a grand mal seizure. And I had no idea what. And that was when I realized that I could not stop. And not only that I could not stop, but I should not stop. That it was actually, I had become unreachable in a way that really was frightening, because none of the people I knew anything about this that we're sitting in the middle of here, the fellowship, recovery, the 12 steps, any of the things that I know now as being my daily bread and butter were beyond my, I had no vision of that. I think I'd seen the Days of Wine and Roses, when they mention AA, they go to an AA meeting in Days of. But so I felt, most of all, I felt so alone. And I could not tell anybody this. I could not tell anybody how frightened I was. So the only thing to do was to carry on. And I carried on, and I carried on, and I carried on. And I caused dreadful grief and pain and embarrassment to everybody around me. And bit by bit, I drove everyone away because it was seen to be the logical thing to do, because I couldn't stand their company. They couldn't stand mine. I couldn't stand to see them suffer. And towards the end, I've always been a fisherman too. I love fishing. My rock bottom was a fishing incident, and it was fairly mundane, but it was profound for me, because the last vestige of respectability I had in my own head was as if this kind of magnificent angling gentleman, And I took my rod down to the river one morning, about 5 a.m, the mist was clearing, and there was a couple of carp fishermen on the other bank, serious dudes who had a tent, and they'd been there probably a week, had all the kit, they were actually the real thing, and I wasn't really, and I'd been drinking already. I had a half bottle underneath the mat where the pedals of the car are, that I'd found, and I set up all my gear. I had some nice hardy carp rods, 11-foot carp rods with bite indicators and all of the stuff. And I went to sit down. I lost my balance, and I fell on one of the rods and broke it clean across the handle. And these guys looked away, And that was it, man. It was like being kicked in the stomach. And I don't know. I do know why. I didn't know why then, but I know why now, is that that was it. It was the last straw. It was the last straw. I had nothing left. I had nothing left to fool myself with. I'd really kind of shit myself. And I went home, picked up the phone, and I went into treatment about a week later. The person I called had been telling me for a long time that, I had a serious problem. And he was the one I kind of put down when I went into treatment as being my significant other, never mind my wife. And I went in there, I went to Hazelden a good while ago. It must have been about 28 years ago. And I tap danced through, I figured out, a shrewd little nut, really. I kind of know how to please people. I figured that one out way back, and I could do it. You know, I did it with the councillors. I managed to kind of really avoid all the main issues, and I got my chip, and I checked out, and a year and a half later, I was drunk again, and it was because I went and picked up, because nobody told me that you shouldn't be doing drugs. You know, I mean, I was in there for alcoholism. I went and did a couple of lines of blow, and I thought, well, this is awful without any, you know, without the booze. I mean, how could anyone do this without mixing it? And so, you know, it was just logical, really, that I should get back in there, and I did, and I went out for about 5 years, and that thing of unconditional love that I talked about at the beginning of the chair was exhibited then, because I had met a couple of people in my first bout of recovery, going to meetings down in the Guildford area. And one of them would come and visit me in my relapse, and he would just listen. You know, he'd come over, and I'd have a, you know, a couple of, because the thing now was I was trying to do controlled drinking, because I knew I was an alcoholic. But I thought, if I can actually measure it, maybe I can live like that, you know? Maybe I can have two or three special brews and two or three brandies in the evening. And the rest of the time, I'll just kind of lay in wait, you know? and hover in some, you know, mentally, physically hover somehow, so that not, you know, not, but God forbid anything get in the way of those two appointments. You know? And I lived like that for a long time, and it was the most painful part of my life, the most painful part of my life. Of all the things I've been through, it was the worst, and because it was neither one or the other, and no one could be anywhere, and I was just miserable and pissed off and angry and vitriolic, and the only person who would come anywhere near me was this guy, and his name was Brian, and he would come and listen to me, and that's all he did, and that, you know, is what I learned to be unconditional love. He didn't judge. He didn't say, oh, maybe you should, you know, there's a chair waiting for you. He never mentioned it. And it was just his example that got me back in here. I thought, I mean, it was something about this. I was a spiritual guy. Either that or he carried a spiritual message. And whatever it was, I came back. I mean, I did one day. I just went, fuck all this control. I went out and bought a bottle of a crate of wine, fine wine, and a couple of bottles of vodka, and I blitzed. And then I went back into treatment. And halfway through treatment, too, I felt this kind of I felt a real strange dilemma, because I knew I was coming to the end of my tenure there, and nothing had changed. So I had reached that point where many of us get to. That I was in a really safe place, but I still felt very threatened and frightened, because I hadn't really dealt with the main issue of my disease, which was that I needed to ask for help from something other than what I could see or touch. You know, I was in this place, and I was following all the suggestions, and I was working along the right lines, but I had not acknowledged the bottom line, really. And then one day I got on my knees and I asked for help, because I was absolutely petrified. I knew if I went out, it would happen all over again. It was, you know, it was the same old game plan. And believe it or not, you know, the mist cleared. And I've been praying ever since. It'll be 20 years in November. And I get on my knees every morning and every night, and I say please and thank you. Variations of that, one way or another. And that has worked. And for no other reason for that, I would do it. I would do it. I don't know what I believe in, but I believe with all my being. And I ask for help whenever and wherever I can. I mean, I got on my knees at home about an hour before I came here tonight. I was on my knees. And all I ask for is to be able to tell the truth, stay sober, and help to carry the message so that I may be able to help someone in this room. And I have no theories, I have no opinions on any of this. I don't care to think about what has happened, because my brain can't make sense of the slightest thing. I have no faith in this at all. And the minute it starts to formulate things, forget it. I mean, I could come up with all kinds of ideas for you and for me too, but I would rather hear you tell me what you did, and then I can kind of work from that, you know. But I believe in experience, and I believe in my higher power, and I believe in this fellowship. And my sponsor, well, he became my sponsor, this chap. I asked him to be my sponsor after I came back in. And we went through the steps together. And it's been a long, great journey, you know, and some pretty heavy stuff took place right at the beginning. I mean, I in my relapse, I started two new families with women I had absolutely no feeling for whatsoever. And those kids, I have a 22-year-old daughter from my relapse who's a wonderful young woman. And I had a little boy who died when I was 3 years sober. And he kind of got me really into the home stretch of my recovery, because at that point, I could have been on the way out again. But I kind of looked at his death as a way of really giving me an extra strong message for anyone who thinks there's an excuse to drink. Because I've had it, you know, I've been there, and I never once actually considered it. You know, it never once really became an impulse or an issue for me. I went to meetings, I listened, I let people hold me, I let you love me, really. And that was the way it worked for me. I didn't really care very much for myself when I came in here. I'd gone too far down that road of self-loathing. I really didn't know whether I was worth it. So, I mean, when people say, you've got to come here for you, I don't hold with that. You come here for whatever reason you need to come here, and we will love you until you love yourself. And that's what happened with me, because it took me years to start to come to terms with who I was and what I'd done. And when I did, I started to work on what was there. You know, I learned through working the steps that I need to embrace me. I need to embrace my defects, for instance, before I can let go of them. And so I kind of like who I am today. I am, you know, I've done a lot of work on it. I live a fairly quiet, moderate life. I mean, it's been an exciting journey, and it's kind of wound down. I mean, from the day when I came in here, it was all like a roller coaster, and now it's sort of evened out. And I like who I am. I like the life I have. I have three young kids and a lovely young wife and a great, great set of friends and acquaintances in the fellowships. And, you know, I'm a kind of a young old timer. And the thing that I'm most grateful for is that I want this. You know, in AA we say the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. The most valuable thing I have in my life today is that desire. Because I could come here for a little while and get fixed and go away again. But I want to stay this way. And the only way I'm going to be able to keep that is by giving it away. Is by coming here, doing service, and sharing my experience with you. And that's what I hope I've done tonight. So thanks for letting me share.